Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Hello, and welcome back to our podcast. I hope that, like me, you enjoyed a bit of a break over the summer and that you feel a bit refreshed as we enter the fall. Or if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, you're looking forward to your spring. I'm feeling ready to take on a new season, but before we launch a new season, I wanted to share this conversation on agroforestry that ties in with the two episodes we closed with in the spring. We ended last spring with two conversations on farming, that practice which is at the heart of the word culture itself. As I mentioned before, the word culture in its oldest uses referred to the cultivation of the land or the tending of animals. Farming is kind of the perfect topic for this podcast because it speaks to the best and the worst of our relationship with the natural world. Unlike, say, drilling for oil or mining, its impact can be harmful or beneficial depending on how we do it. My guest for this podcast understands this better than most people. John Rulak has an impressive and varied CV. He's an entrepreneur who started several companies, including the organic food company Nativa. He is the executive producer of the movie Kiss the Ground on regenerative agriculture, narrated by Woody Harrelson. It's a wonderful film. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. You can watch it on Netflix, or if you don't have Netflix, it's also available on Vimeo. And more recently, he started an enterprise called Agroforestry Regeneration Communities. This is what I wanted to talk to him about. This nonprofit organization works with farmers in Central America and East Africa who create different versions of what are called food forests. I don't know about you, but I love that term, food forests. I find it so evocative. As you'll learn in listening to our conversation, this approach to farming, which revives techniques that have been in use for thousands of years, allows farmers to restore ecosystems and bring diversified nutrition and economic development to their communities. For those of you who are not familiar with the term agroforestry, I began by asking John Rulak to explain what it is.
Agroforestry is essentially the use of planting trees for various functions. It could be for timber, another could be for food, another could be for biodiversity. And when you think about it, what we work with is we take farmers, a lot of times the farmers we work with in Guatemala and Malawi, for instance, are growing corn. They grow a lot of corn. Sometimes it's a slash and burn, or they do a lot of agriculture practices that aren't the best for the environment. And it's just something that they've been doing for a generation or two. And, you know, we like to share that if you could mimic the forest, you know, there's some good benefits. When you think about it, if you walk through a forest, do you see irrigation pipes? Are we irrigating forests? Don't think so. Forests are very abundant, all sorts of growth of different plants and trees. Are we using synthetic fertilizers in the forest? No.
Nope.
And a diverse forest ecosystem can rely on the rainfall of the area, and it cycles its own nutrients. So it's independent and dynamic. And so we take the best of that natural forest system and bring it into agriculture. It's actually too simple. And initially, people go, well, we don't want trees. We cut down trees. If there's trees near the fields, we cut them down. But when we talk about the forest, the farmers, some of these small farmers, they go, oh, I see that. And when they literally plant different types of trees in their agricultural fields, it gets some shade because a lot of times plants do like some shade. And we plant trees that essentially are a fertilizer tree. They fix nitrogen from the air, and that does especially well in droughts. The yields only drop a small amount, whereas their neighbor's fields drop significantly because there's less organic matter. So there's a lot of benefits. And then when we say a food forest, the idea is we're using trees, multi-species, multi-layers. So we have grasses and ground covers and bushes and then various types of trees. And I'll give you an example of like in Guatemala, we'll take a part of these farmers' cornfields and we'll say, let's put in a food forest. And we plant it on contour lines and we'll plant a nitrogen fixing tree called Glitterceria. Grows very fast. And plants need nitrogen. Like, for instance, corn is a heavy nitrogen feeder, and soybeans fix nitrogen. So it depends on the kind of crop. And so we'll plant these kind of fertilizer trees, if you can use that as an analogy. And then next to it, we'll grow different trees like avocados and mangoes, bananas, etc. And then we'll do some more nitrogen trees. And then we'll do what we call alley crops. So we'll do pineapple. We'll do ginger, turmeric, cassava, which we're now making cassava pizzas, gluten-free pizzas at one of our centers in Antigua, Guatemala, that Contour Lines, which is one of our partners. Agroforestry Regeneration Communities, which I founded, we don't start any new projects. We work with existing projects that we like and that we help support and help them go to the next level. And this kind of food forest, and they're based in Guatemala, and they have 2,000 family farmers that have put in planted food forests. We provide the planting materials and the trainings. And to give an example of the economic benefit, one of these small farmers harvested 100 pineapples. He carried them probably with some of his family in a remote area all the way down to the river, got in his little boat, took the boat down to the town of Livingston, emptied them out, put on the street corner, and sold all 100 pineapples, probably like for a dollar each or about $100. And that's a huge win for a small farmer. So not only does our food forest increase biodiversity, not only does it reduce erosion, you know, attracts, you know, beneficial insects and provides habitat for birds, not only does it provide more nutrition for the people, because you can only get so much nutrition from corn. And that's what mostly these farmers, it's interesting, whether you're in Guatemala in Central America or Malawi in Southeastern Africa, they don't have very good nutrition because corn is a big part of their diet. But if you're eating mangoes and bananas and ginger and cassava, you get different nutrition from this. So it helps the nutrition. And of course, it makes the economics better for them. So it's a win-win all around.
That's beneficial on so many levels. It sounds like these food forests must be beautiful as well, with such diverse crops and the contour lines and everything. I've seen some pictures, but it really makes me want to go to Antigua and check it out.
Yeah. And here's the irony. It's so simple and so effective. And it's the one program that the U.S. government, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, major foundations all over the world, and governments, even in their own countries, won't support.
Why do you think that is? Does it have to do with how in bed they are with big agriculture? Is that why you think that's true? Or
it's a complex reason, but it's so bizarre when this is literally the low-hanging fruit of regenerative agriculture, the low-hanging fruit, the easiest to do to create food security, to sequester the most carbon, to prevent starvation. And it's the one thing that what I call the 0.1%, you know, people who are worth over $100 million, it's the one thing that they won't fund. You know, they love to fund intense chemical agriculture. They love to blame cows and fund billions and billions of dollars on fake meat. That's going to be the solution. They love to design high-tech steel with engineers that's going to sequester carbon with giant fans in the middle of a desert. They love to do that. But the simple low-hanging fruit solution, they're like MIA. The irony is this has been known for decades, but it doesn't make money for Wall Street, and it doesn't make money for the chemical companies, and it empowers local people to be self-reliant. But, you know, in Malawi, 80% of the population are poor farmers. So there's 19 million people. And right now in our program, we're working with 1,000 farmers. We work there with Permaculture Paradise Institute. It's one of our community partners with Agroforestry Regeneration Communities. We'll train like 60 or 100 farmers at a time. And we require that they go and then train one other farmer. In this last year and a half, we've trained 1,000 farmers, and we put in 4 nurseries. We give them seedlings and trees to plant, and we work with the farmers who are the most open to it, you know. And also, I would just like to say we're creatures of habit. You know, there's certain things that us humans no matter what we do in our life, wherever we are, we just, it's like when you go on vacation, most people go to the same place that they used to or something similar, some of their friends. They don't necessarily go out of their way, you know?
Yeah. I think habit is kind of a useful word because, you know, one of the things that I've been really interested in is how, as a society, we become attached to these ideas of this is how things are, you know, this is how the world is. Often our notion of how the world is something that's 20 years old at the most, right? But those habits can become ingrained in a very short period of time. One of the things that I find interesting about agroforestry personally, as, you know, a bit of a nerd, is the fact that it is such an old form of farming that really predates, well, it predates agriculture, you know, in the sense of tilling the land. Are you familiar at all with William Bryant Logan's book, Sproutlands? Have you come across that?
I'm not.
Well, I would recommend it. It's specifically about the techniques of coppicing and pollarding, basically ways of pruning trees where you either prune sort of from the ground up so that you can have livestock in the forest, or pollarding as a way of harvesting from trees without having to sort of cut the tree down to the ground. But one of the things that's interesting in his book is that he talks about how these forms of managing the forest to raise livestock and also to have crops is thousands and thousands of years old. And so that's one of the things that I find interesting about agroforestry. And I imagine that in different regions of the world, if you go back, there probably are practices that were indigenous to those regions. I wonder if that's something you've come across at all.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So a couple of things. Agroforestry, one of the terms that's used is called chop and drop. When these corn growers, small corn growers, you know, depending where they're at in the world, they'll grow these, like every 5 meters, they'll put in a nitrogen fixing tree. Then they come in, they harvest the corn crop. And then before they plant the next season, they'll come in and chop the tree down, you know, chop a lot of the branches and leaves, fall down. Those are rich in nitrogen. And then they'll plant the corn. And then as the tree grows up, then they'll harvest the corn, then they'll let it continue to grow more, and then they'll chop it. So yeah, we do that. Agroforestry has been practiced by indigenous peoples, you know, for millennia. To give you a couple examples, there's the Maya Forest Garden. Dr. Ford has done some great work there, where in Guatemala, in Mexico, in Belize, Honduras, where the Mayan Empire was, that was a very common thing. They would go into the wild forest. They would remove some of the trees. They would plant gardens. Then as the forest would grow out over 10 or 15 years, then they would go to another spot. I was just talking to some folks working on building food forests on Oahu. And when they've been removing some of the invasive trees, they noticed there was some very interesting, you know, kind of rock work and natural systems that the Hawaiians from 150 years ago. And so by removing some of those non-native trees, they're allowing a little more light, and some of the breadfruit and the taro, they have a whole system of growing crops. And in Hawaii is in a very dangerous situation because, like many places in the world, 150 years ago, boats didn't arrive with huge amounts of food to feed people. We've learned to do that over the last 75 years. Most people in Hawaii live out of a Costco, as do they do in Los Angeles and in Mexico City all over. The challenge we're in is that we're facing huge challenges in erratic weather, supply chain disruptions, wars, and an aging farming population. The average farmer in the United States is in their 60s, and all over the world, the young people, they're going to the cities. They don't want to necessarily be a farmer. Now we're working to change that in our community as much as we can. So it's a real challenge. So how we produce our food locally is very important. And in Hawaii, they're starting to think about that and tapping into some of that traditional Hawaiian indigenous knowledge of relying on some of these different crops, such as breadfruit, such as taro, cassava, yams, etc. Yeah, so we do have some historical references to draw upon, and that's one of the reasons why we're in the situation where we are today. Like if you look in the United States, when the European settlers arrived, whether it was Mexico or US and Canada, there was an assumption that they were a backward people, that they were just literally going out and simple hunting and gathering, and they weren't cultivating. And this was far from the case, that the indigenous people were using fire to create more sunlight for more animals, for more berries. They were doing regenerative agriculture in various ways. But we didn't see that because we felt like they were less than, and we were people of God, of Christians, with our hierarchy and cosmology. And because of that, we ignored them. And now we're starting to see massive fires because of our disrespect for nature. I'll give another example of just of how that might play out. So in 1975, there was a company in Humboldt, California, and it was a timber company. It was called Pacific Lumber. And they had a mill, a very productive mill. They had lots of employees. And a Texas Raider came in and said, "We're going to now just cut all the trees." And before that, they would harvest large trees, but they would leave many of the big trees. And so the forest was a managed old growth forest. Now this came in, they cut all the trees. And then in 25 years, there was no trees left for the job. So they did a massive layoff. In the process, they blamed environmentalists for protecting the trees. When you have a fire, if you go through a forest that has old trees, there's more old trees and there's a lot less young trees, where today we have a lot of immature, very thin trees and some larger trees. The fire goes very slowly through an old growth forest. It goes very fast through a third or fourth growth forest. So we didn't understand these natural systems at our peril. And really, we reward economics. So the accounting people and the financial people liquidated our natural resources in our country and on the planet in the last, you know, few hundred years. And now we're paying the price for that because we are disconnected from nature.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the logic of capitalism that is predicated on growth and on consumption has kind of mapped itself in all of these practices, definitely to our peril. I wanted to go over, you know, talking about why this shift in approach to farming is so important, just go over some of the basic elements of the problems that have resulted from industrial agriculture. And you were the executive producer of the film Kiss the Ground, which I think does an incredible job of giving an overview of these problems and what some of the potential solutions are. So, you know, I would definitely recommend to my listeners, if they haven't seen it, to see it. But I just wanted to go over some of the main points because I think it's really important in order to understand why the kinds of farming practices that you're promoting are so important, beginning with the problem of erosion, which is an age-old problem that really goes back to the invention of the plow, right?
Right, yeah. The plow is very destructive. So what do you think the leading export by tonnage is of the United States every year? It's below our feet. Guess what it is?
Soil.
Yeah. We export 2 trillion tons a year. I'm pretty sure that's the right number, though I could have it off. But it is the largest export by tonnage in the world. And it's blowing off and it flowing into our rivers, you know, from the Mississippi to the wetlands and watershed in Maryland, all over. And so we're losing more topsoil than we did in the Great Depression. But instead of it blowing away, a lot of times it's washing away. And so some people say there's 60 harvests left. You see that number? I think it's actually much less than that. Topsoil it's our inherited wealth that we received from nature, from the generation before us that has protected it. And now we're abusing it. And so we do that at our peril. And when you do the basic tenets of regenerative agriculture, keep the soil covered, increase biodiversity, integrate animals into your operations instead of separating them, and growing a diversity of different crops, and looking at the context, are you on the edge of a forest ecosystem, or are you on the plains you know, with no trees and vast grasslands. Each place will determine what the context is. But the soil is our natural wealth, and we can rebuild that soil. The one thing they're finding is the soil can sequester vast amounts of carbon. The vast majority of the carbon that is in the atmosphere and that's in the oceans, and the oceans are a huge carbon sink, you know, this came from our soils by stripping the land, by overplowing, by burning crops. And all that material can be returned from the atmosphere and the oceans through the restoration of the land. And if we don't restore our land, our oceans will perish. Right now, we've increased the acidification in the oceans by 30%, the acidification, which essentially means that the plankton that live in the oceans, which supply 60% of our oxygen, that are the basis for the food chain for the entire ocean, which is, we don't live on a land planet, we live on an ocean planet. 70% of the globe is oceans. And that plankton, the acidification keeps increasing, and we've lost 50, 60% of our plankton in the last 100 years. And the plankton is dying off because of higher temperatures and excess carbon that goes from the land up into the atmosphere and then falls into the oceans. And if you accelerate the acidification that's going to be in the oceans by 2040, when the scientists do that, the plankton dissolves. And this is another example. To me, the number one environmental issue facing the planet is ocean acidification. Because if we lose the oceans, we lose everything. I'm more concerned about the health of the plankton than whether the ocean's going to rise 6 inches 10 years from now. But that carbon that's in the oceans can be the fuel for regenerative agriculture. Our systems run on carbon. It's the gasoline. So farmers doing regenerative agriculture, they switch from using pesticides and herbicides and fungicides and chemical fertilizers. And they don't do it in day one. It's like a heroin addict doesn't get off of heroin. We've been the simple tool. And it's not like farmers want to do that. It's not like they want to use all these chemicals, but that's what they learned when they went to Iowa State. When they went to UC Davis in 1985, the professors said, if you have pests, go out and spray chemicals, spray Roundup on it.
Yeah.
They didn't say, maybe you could do a strip of pollinator plants along the side. Maybe you could diversify your crops. Maybe you could run cattle after you grow your wheat, and that could deal with some of the weed issues. But that carbon is really important. The farmers do that. Then they increase the carbon matter. It pulls the carbon from the oceans. The oceans can start to regenerate our atmosphere. And also, interestingly, there are some scientists that say the major problem with erratic climate weather is not carbon. Now, this goes against everything that you read in the New York Times and the latest scientific journals. But one thing we've forgotten is we've forgotten the water cycle. And the majority of the gases in the atmosphere is water, not carbon. And so how do we deal with that? By keeping a living root, by doing agroforestry, by doing cover crops. If you drive through Kansas today in the wintertime, 90% of the fields are bare. And massive windstorms like the worst and like the dust bowls on a bad day. So we can cover that. And so the irony is the solution is so simple and so profound, yet it's exactly what we won't do because of the economic, social, and political reasons. You know, the Biden administration wants to use climate smart agriculture. They won't use the word regenerative agriculture. When you get the Secretary of State off of microphone and he goes, he knows the soil is important. He knows this thing that we're really doing. But he's dealing with economic forces that are so powerful, he can't implement where we need to go. We're doing it at the edges, but not enough. And there's also a monopoly. If you're in Kansas or in Oklahoma and you grow wheat, guess how many places you can sell it to? There's these grain elevators controlled by four companies. They control 90% of the wheat. if you're ranching cattle, there's four companies control like 70% or more of meat, chicken, and beef. And they don't reward farmers and ranchers to invest. Now, there are starting to change. There's companies like Cargill. There's companies like General Mills that if you talk to their CEOs, they're going to say that regenerative agriculture is important, that we need to help the farmers take care of it. And they are starting to make some change. Are they doing it fast enough? No. Is it going to change the system in such a way as to reduce the chances of an ecological and food crisis? Many people think it may be too late, but, you know, at the same time, I have a lot of people that are been involved in this movement, and we just keep moving forward. We don't want to like give up and say, well, you know, the system's corrupt, we'll just forget about it and I'll just, you know, do whatever I'm going to do. So, you know, a lot of us believe that nature is very resilient, and maybe we'll get a little luck and maybe more people will wake up. As we move closer to a more erratic weather and more ecological biodiversity collapse, hopefully more people will wake up. And not only is it the plankton in the oceans, but we've lost 70% of all winged insects. And the number one reason, I'm talking about butterflies, moths, ladybugs, bees, bumblebees. We've lost 75%. And we're losing 1% a year. And the major cause is synthetic pesticides. Every seed that we plant of GMO corn and soy and cotton, and even non-organic, is dipped in something called neonics. Neonics is a form of a pesticide. It's one of the most toxic pesticides the world's ever seen. It's banned in France, where now bees are starting to make a comeback. And we coat every seed that we plant, every Monsanto, every Bayer, all those crops that we're planting to prevent potentially things in the soil to eat away the seed. You know, a lot of farmers are not using that and adopting regenerative practices. And how it works is that neonic expresses itself in every cell of the plant, even if it's only at a few parts per billion. And then in the morning dew, when the bees come, they drink the dew off the tassels of the corn. They're sipping these neonics and they're dying. And we're also seeing 70% of all birds in the world die in the last 50 years. Population reducing. We've seen 98% of all sardines, the Pacific sardines, which is the basis of the food web in the Pacific, the plankton sardines. And again, we've seen cases where humans, where we've reduced lead and we've seen our DDT and we've seen bald eagles regenerate and come back, which is great. So we have the potential. And there are farmers now and ranchers that are becoming part of this. And the question is can we make that change? And I continue to be hopeful that more people will adopt this and we will regenerate and take care of Earth and nature because it's in our own best interest.
Absolutely. I hesitate to add this now that you've brought things to such a beautiful conclusion, but you mentioned something earlier that I was just curious about. You talked about fake meat that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and USDA and so on, that they see that as part of the solution to the climate crisis. And I could sort of hear you rolling your eyes. So I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah. It is a utter disaster. Fake meat sales at grocery stores are actually declining. We've spent tens of billions of dollars. And essentially what their plan is, the biggest agriculture companies had an issue 10 years ago. People didn't want their GMO corn and soy. They didn't want their industrial crops, and they wanted more organic and healthier type foods. So they've repackaged the worst aspects of agriculture under a new, great, creative marketing terms, and it's called plant-based. Now, you know, in the film Kiss the Ground, we show you can rock a regenerative diet, whether you're going to eat 100% pasture beef, which sequester carbon, and the National, you know, Audubon Society is showing increases wildlife, bird habitat when it's done in a correct way, following pretty much the patterns of wild buffalo herds by moving the animals quickly through systems. And you can do it also through a vegetarian diet as well. But we've decided we're going to take these GMO corn and soy to make fake meat, or we're going to take those sugars from GMO corn, sugar, et cetera, and we're going to build giant factories with huge steel vats and steel tubes running all over. And the capital expenditure is hundreds of billions of dollars to do that. And then the cost, you have to have all sorts of engineers. And the price is like 15x the cost to do it today. Now, there may be some companies that may figure out some better mousetrap, you know, but literally the raw materials that most of these companies are using is in fact killing bees and butterflies and destroying our soils. So how is that a solution? You know, literally in Guatemala or Malawi with $20 million, we could build out 10% of their smallholder farmers to have food forests and be food secure and help their communities with $20 million. But instead, the lure of economic return means we're going to fund and support this. And if you go to my Substack, I've written several articles about this. I wrote an article called Make America Rivers Blue Again. And Monsanto and Bayer, they've essentially corrupted organizations from 350.org to Sierra Club. So the major environmental organizations are promoting this anti-cow or just ignore it. And their message is coal and oil is bad. Solar and wind and electric cars and this green techno-utopia is the solution. End of subject. Do we need to stop drilling for oil as much and doing more better mileage cars, electric cars? Yes, but that's not the solution, the end all, be all, end all. But Wall Street and the largest foundations in the world would rather fund that techno-utopia solution versus soil health and change the food system. Food is bigger than agriculture. So you can vote with your dollar. You can compost. You can grow a little food on your deck or in your garden. You can support local farmers. You can compost those banana peels. And you can also support ranchers and farmers that are doing it more a regenerative way. So that's what I encourage people to do.
Going forward, we'll be exploring a number of topics at the intersection of culture and the natural world, from the history of horses to the culture of capitalism. If you have suggestions or ideas you would like to share, email me at askwith, that's askuith, .intheweeds@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at intheweedspod. Check out the French poster I recently put up and tell me what you think. Be back soon.